Good to see each one this evening, and we're glad that you're here. We're talking about Israel this evening and the archaeological evidence that relates to the Old Testament. We have a lesson similar to this that deals with the New, but you don't get to hear that this time. There is a tremendous amount of evidence, and I by no means make claim to present even most of it. I'm a little bit selfish in my selection of the things that I want to talk to you about. These are things that I have had something to do with, sometimes a small part, but have been related to it. In order to understand the implications and some of the battles that are going on in the context of the work of archaeology in Israel, you need to know that there are enemies that are fighting the truth, that are fighting the evidence. Let me give you some examples. This is Dr. Herzog, who's professor of archaeology at the largest university in Israel, Tel Aviv University. And you would think in Israel, the largest Israeli university, he's going to be in favor of evidence that would support the Bible. And, well, let's just see what he tells us about archaeology. This is what archaeologists have learned from their excavations in the land of Israel. Israelites were never in Egypt, did not conquer the land in a military campaign, and did not pass it on to the 12 tribes of Israel. That's what we've learned in archaeology. Now, most of what he learned is negative, and those, I think, who are objective in the study of archaeology understand you can't prove a negative in archaeology. If you haven't found it yet, you might find it tomorrow, evidence to support the idea. And at best, he's not found it yet, but he says we proved that these things didn't happen, which I think betrays some lack of objectivity. But why would he make a statement like this? This is in the context of a major battle, well, many major battles, many of which are political, have nothing to do with science. Let's compare it with a similar statement that I think will provide some perspective. The late Yasser Arafat, who of course was the former president of the Palestinian Authority, very much anti-Jewish, made this statement. He says, the notion of a Jewish origin in Jerusalem is a religious myth used to justify occupation and colonialism. Now, we understand where he's coming from and why he would just be blind to any evidence that showed the Jews had been there. He denies there was ever a temple. But why would an Israeli archaeologists say this? Well, he doesn't want to make these folks mad. They're trying to live in peace there, and they're having a hard time doing that. And they're not believers. It's more convenient. It's more politically expedient. Together with the situation that we find in America, where if you're going to be among the intelligentsia, you can't be a believer in God and in the supernatural. And all of those factors then come together to produce quite a conflict. We're interested, though, in the facts, in the evidence, and not the prejudices and the pressures that influence some people. But we want you to know about it. I'll begin this evening looking at the altar of Joshua. And the context that we just described is a part of this story. This was a pile of stones that was found by Adam Zertal, who was an atheist at the time. He was head of the Department of Archaeology at a university up in northern Israel. And it turns out this is Joshua's altar, I believe. We recall that as they crossed the Jordan, they came into Israel. They were at Shiloh for a while, which I believe we found, and then moved on to Samaria and the mountains of Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, We read about this in Deuteronomy 28. There, they had the reading of the law. Now, we've got people in education here that maybe can take a lesson here. He's reading the law, and how do you get people to understand this is something you have to do? Well, he put part of them on Mount Ebal, he put part of them on Mount Gerizim. And after he read the law, the ones on Ebal responded, and we'll get to the response that they were given. But here's the command from Deuteronomy 27 that was given by Moses. When you get to Mount Ebal, you build an altar to the Lord, and there the ones at Mount Gerizim read the blessings. This is what's going to happen if you obey. And then across the valley, over to Mount Ebal, here are the ones who read the curses, and they have to express that themselves. Here's the law. Here's what's going to happen if you do it. Here's what's going to happen if you don't. Very interesting story. Here we see the picture of the location where this took place, Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, right across from each other. Adam Zertal didn't believe any of it. In fact, he didn't even know the story of the altar of Joshua as he was investigating this, doing a survey of this territory for the University of Haifa. And at that time, he was chairman of that department. Well, what is this? And as he began to research, this wasn't like anything else that he found. And he thought, well, maybe what? And he began reading and found out about the altar of Joshua that was on Mount Ebal. Maybe that's what it is. And he suggested this in some of the literature. And, of course, the people responded saying, this is just nuts. Here's Dr. Lawrence Stagger, who's professor of archaeology of Israel at Harvard. He says, if a sacrificial altar stood on Mount Ebal, its impact on our research is revolutionary. All of us have to go back to kindergarten, because there was no Joshua. He was like Zeus and some of the other gods that people made up. And this is what Adam had been taught and was teaching. And this was the response. Some said, well, maybe it's a farmhouse, or maybe it's a watchtower. Well, it didn't have any windows and any doors. It wouldn't make a very good farmhouse. It was short and squatty, and it wasn't on top of the mountain. Some had looked on top, because that's what was described in the text. It wasn't there. But this, actually, the text says it's in the mountain, which can be interpreted on or not on top, about two-thirds of the way up. Well, what is it? And he began to do more research and excavation. Here we see the picture taken with a wide-angle lens, which somewhat exaggerates the distance from Ebal, the altar, across to Mount Gerizim. And one question that I had is, you know, how do they read the law here and then talk back and forth? This is a long ways away. How does this work? No loudspeakers, no internet to communicate. And so we sent Dr. Dyer with several others that were with us across. He has his doctorate in archaeology from UCLA. And shouted at him as he got across to Mount Gerizim, Dr. Dyer, can you hear us? And he spoke back in very conversational tone. Yeah, I can hear you. And it just makes chills go up and down your spine. This is amazing. It's a natural amphitheater that amplifies the sound, and you can hear very clearly. Wow, God knew where to tell him to go to do this. As he continued to excavate, the area was obviously a place where there was an encampment. There were barriers that he restored to look like this. The altar, here is the guts of it. It was covered with plaster. This is the inside. Looked like this. With plaster over it, it looked probably like this. And we notice from Exodus the instructions for how to build the Israelite altar. Now, of course, the Palestinians had their altars, and they went up by steps, like the Ziggurats. God said, nope, we're not going to do it that way. When you make an altar of stone for me, you'll not build it of cut stones. Now, they knew how to cut stones, and we read from the building of the temple how well and expertly they, and we can see that from some of the structures. But you don't do that when you're building the altar. You'll profane it. Do not go up by steps to my altar so that your nakedness will not be exposed on it. And so that's exactly the kind of structure that we're looking at. And in this hole in the center is where they found all kinds of bones and ashes of burnt animals. It was full of that. As they took this to here Hebrew University, the Department of Zoology, they began to examine to try to find out what kind of animals. Well, if this is a pagan altar, then you've got eagles and maybe bear bones, various kinds of animals, snakes they particularly worshipped. But here we found 942 bones from some 50 to 100 individuals, and all of them were sheep, goats, and bulls. Isn't that interesting? Sounds pretty kosher to me, doesn't it? Sheep, goats, bulls, of the ones they could determine the age and sex of, they were all one-year-old males. I think we got an Israelite altar here. This is what Leviticus tells us. And as they continued to look at the ashes that were in the center, we're going in the wrong direction here, I'm sorry. They uncovered all kinds of pottery, and we'll get back to where we need to be in just a moment. And they were able to date the pottery fairly reasonably, which came out to precisely the time of the Exodus, with thermoluminescent dating as well as cultural dating from the shape of the pottery. Okay, here's pottery from the time of the Exodus. Here's bones like the Israelites would sacrifice right at the spot where God told Joshua to build an altar. It's beginning to pile up a pretty good bit of evidence here, and it was a real honor to be able to work with Adams et al., who was convinced of the validity of the Word of God and also the Messiah as a result of our efforts together. And especially as he saw the kind of response of the, quote, scientific community, which didn't respond very scientifically, he said, what happened regarding the new accumulation of facts that I've cited? And he's publishing this in an archaeological journal. Almost nothing. He had several, a sequence of articles that he published, and they guffawed initially. And then after he began to provide the evidence, they just shut up. Since the appearance of the detailed reports and the many articles I have published on the new excavations, silence has descended on the scholarly world. And they gave up the opposition. In fact, I think we can say at this point that Dr. Steiger needs to go back to kindergarten, which is the way he assessed the situation. I think he has established the case. Dr. Zatal has established what appears to be a New Testament church there in Samaria, in the middle of Hamas territory, and there are about 40 that are attending there without any connection with any denominational organization. He says he wants to do it the way he finds it in the New Testament, and I find that very encouraging. We move on to Jericho, where he had done some work, but we recall the story, a very familiar story in the Bible, where they were told to march around the city. This is when they first came into the land of Palestine. And you march around it for 6 days, you blow the trumpets, everybody will shout, and the walls will fall down flat. And I can just imagine Joshua explaining this to his soldiers. You know, we're going to march around the walls and shout, and the walls will fall down. Well, what's plan B? You got any other ideas? But they were persuaded to do it God's way, which is exactly what they did. When you do this, he said, you'll blow the trumpets, you'll shout, they'll fall down flat, and the people will go straight ahead. Big walls. You go straight ahead. How did that happen? Well, we go to that city today. This is the modern city of Jericho. And in the background, you see the tell. This is the mound that is the remnants of the ancient city of Jericho. And you can see from the aerial view that a great deal of excavation has occurred there. And it's been a major battleground. Early in the 1900s, Garstang did some monumental work and concluded, absolutely, this was Joshua's Jericho. But then enters Kathleen Kenyon. And here we should hear booze. One of the bad people, in my view. But she says this was from a much earlier date than the biblical Jericho. And the proof was that there was none of the Cypriot pottery that ought to be there. A special fine pottery from Cyprus ought to have been there. She was digging in the poor part of the city. This is fine pottery. And I think we can understand why she didn't find it in her digs. But that was proof in her mind. She did acknowledge in her book that it had been burned, blackened by fire, and the debris was heavily burnt, and mentioned the bricks that had fallen. Bryant Wood, who is a devout believer, professor of Near Eastern Studies, University of Toronto, whom I've worked with on several occasions there and at AI, found the fallen brick that surrounded the city. And we do have one of those bricks from the walls of Jericho here on display that you can examine. The schematic that he drew from what he found looks like this. And you can see that earthen cell on which that city was built and the retaining wall around it. And then the fallen brick all around that fell outward and made a ramp. And with that ramp of fallen brick all the way around the city, you can see that they could march each one straight ahead, just as the text had described. He continued to excavate, and in 2001, he found the diagnostic Cypriot pottery that Kathleen Kenyon said proved it wasn't because it wasn't there. Well, if then you find it, what does that prove? By her criteria, it is there. And this is one of the best examples that has been found of that Cypriot pottery that you may want to examine. It's very different from the typical pottery and rather easy to recognize. In addition, he found a series of Egyptian scarabs. I have one of them, but that got left behind. You'll have to come to the Patton Museum of Natural History in Hot Springs in order to see that. A series with dates on them. Now, in archaeology, this is just almost too good to be true. They're dated, and they go right up to the time of the conquest, and they stop. I think that tells you what happened. The people from Israel had some of these with them. They were to stamp important documents, and they're found there at Jericho. One of the most amazing things that was found, and one that most impressed me, was that a small portion of the wall is still standing on the north side of the city. The only part that still stands, and you can see a house built into the wall on that small portion that remains. Recall in Joshua 2 that Rahab lived in a house on the wall, and she allowed the spies to go down because her house was on the city wall. I think I know who lived there. She was promised that her house would be spared if she took care of the spies. Now, the word translated house there is almost always, about 80% of the time at least, referring to the dwelling. Sometimes it can refer to a family. But almost always it's used to that. Her house would be spared is what it literally says. There it is. One house that's still standing from the walls of Jericho. How many of you know about the prophet Balaam? the prophet that had his donkey talk to him. Wow. The skeptics ridicule and say, this is a ridiculous story and couldn't be true, had to be made up. Well, we recall the story occurred as the Israelites from the Exodus were coming across, approaching the Israelite territory. And as they approached, they came to Moab. Moab was afraid. They would be destroyed. Ammon had heard about them. Edom had. And he sent down to Midian to get Balaam, who was a prophet, not of the Israelites, but of the Midianites, to come curse the people. And of course, he knew better than that. He said so. But then he was offered a lot of money, and he thought he'd try again. And most of you know the story that as he tried, he was stopped and controlled. Just above is Ammon, who are also involved in the conflict with Israel. And up in Ammon, we find an interesting tell there at the Jabbok River in the Jordan, on the Jordan side of the Jordan River. And that tell has been excavated, and there we find an administration city of the Amorites that has been excavated, and that administration building has a wall that is covered with plaster, and a lot of writing of historical events are described there. Now, this is not Israelites. These are the Amorites that were next door to the Moabites that were the ones that were hiring the prophet Balaam. But in the fallen tile that had the history written on it, written in red and in black ink, that's now in the museum in Amman, Jordan, that we've been able to examine, you've got a jigsaw puzzle. You put that back together. There were fairly good-sized pieces here, and you might recognize my hand there in the picture that we were able to work with some of that. I didn't translate it, but we had some experts with us who did. Warning given by Balaam, the son of Peor, a seer of the gods. This was a prophet, Balaam, the son of Peor. We read in Numbers chapter 22, here is Balaam, the son of Peor, described in Scripture, and behold, the people came out of Egypt. Well, of course, even the Exodus is denied, but here is a story related to the Exodus that is verified, not by Israelite writings, but by the enemies of Israel, from archaeology, from this period, verifying the story that we read in Numbers 22, Balaam the son of Peor. I'm sorry, we're going the wrong way again. I'm getting used to a clicker that I'm not normally using. Numbers 22 says, the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey and said to Balaam, what have I done? You've struck me these three times. Crazy story? No. This is a story that is verified by archaeology from the enemies of Israel. I think that's exciting. One of the more interesting finds in Jerusalem that relates to what we were looking at this morning is the oldest Hebrew text in the form of a silver amulet. Now, the papyrus, the various forms of parchment, which are more resistant, are not permanent. But silver plates hold up fairly well. And that was found in Israel, here in the courtyard of now the modern St. Andrew's Scottish Presbyterian Church. And they've known that in the courtyard they had a number of ancient tombs. And Dr. Barkay was, he's one of the good guys. In Israel, a very famous archaeologist who's excavating there, and here one of his helpers is laying down where the body would have been placed. The tomb was over him. It has collapsed. Underneath is the storage area, and it was in that storage area where we find a number of pots that a very interesting artifact was found back over in the corner. It was a silver amulet. It was rolled up. They didn't know what it was, of course, initially. He said it looked like a cigarette butt, almost. Not much larger than that. And then a good friend of mine walked around with it for about 2 weeks in his pocket trying to figure out what it was. It actually took about 10 years to carefully unroll. and then to examine microscopically to show that it had very fine engravings on it. Then a second one was found, likewise carefully unrolled, with the same text written on it. From Numbers 6:24, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you. Here is the priestly blessing that was written on the silver plates rolled up and worn around the neck of the priests. Guess what? The text is identical. No variance. Just exactly like the text that we have today in Jeremiah's time. This is 400 years before the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest Hebrew text. Now, how did they finally, in fact, on the back of the big one, they have recently, with infrared examination, found most of that chapter that was very finely engraved. I think we get a clue from how they did this from Jeremiah 17, which is, of course, speaking figuratively, but it says, here's the sin of Judah written down with an iron stylus with a diamond point engraved on the tablet of their hearts. But, of course, to speak figuratively, he has to refer to something they knew about that was real. They had a diamond point on an iron stylus that would then engrave this very finely, 400 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls, but precisely like the text that we have today. I think that's exciting. Then let's move up to the northern portion of Israel, up at the foot of Mount Hermon, the snow-peaked mountain at the northern end. You remember they talked about from Dan to Beersheba, the two ends of the land of Israel. Then after the 10 northern tribes left, it was from Dan down to Bethel, wasn't it? Well, there were altars that were set up at Dan and at Bethel by Rehoboam to keep the people from going back down to Jerusalem. We know what happened to the altar at Dan as the old prophet and the young prophet there confronted the idolatry. The idol was split, or that is, the altar was split and destroyed. But what happened to the altar up at Dan? Well, we've excavated that tell, and we found the altar. And it's very obvious, even acknowledged by the Department of Antiquities in Israel. The aluminum frame shows the outline of how it looked initially. It crumbled around, but it has been reassembled, and most of it is now in the Jerusalem Museum. Behind it is the foundation of what was a temple that Jeroboam also built that matches the dimensions of the temple in Jerusalem. And I'm standing here on the foundation going up and looking at it. You can see very obviously the dimensions that matches that temple. So he built the temple, he built the altar like it was in Jerusalem, and he had the utensils that were actually found that are also in the museum in Jerusalem that were used to make the sacrifices, the tongs and the forks, just like the pattern that had been given for the temple in Jerusalem that were found at this spot. Going to the south side of the tell, that's more toward the north side, you see the gate of the city of Dan. This is where the judge made judgments, at the gate of the city, and the judges or the elders sat beside him. Remember several references in Scripture to the one who sat at the gate. You remember Job sat at the gate, one of the judges. And this is seen there in the entrance to Dan, and just outside of that area, a very important find was made, the Tel Dan inscription in 93. The archaeologist will tell you, and still say, never has been any archaeological evidence of the dynasty of David. No archaeological evidence, and so that's been disproven. And we'll see some of those statements in a moment. Well, it's just not so. This is one evidence of it. This is a monument that, again, was written by the enemies, bragging about having defeated the Israelites by Hazael, king of Amram. And he talks about defeating the house of David, the dynasty of David, some would translate it. And then names some of those kings of Judah and Israel. And that's recorded in 2 Chronicles 22, the event that he's describing that took place, and here's the monument, and they say, well, we have no archaeological evidence that David ever existed. And there it is. One of the cop-outs that you often hear when you find something they don't want is, well, it wasn't from a Providence dig. It wasn't under the Department of Antiquities. And if they think you're going to find something, you're not going to get a permit. However, this dig was supervised by Abraham Bryan, who was the director of the Department of Antiquities. And you can't get more providenced than that. So that objection won't fly. This is as established as it gets and is certainly verification of the House of David. So, summarizing then just a general view of some of the things that I've had some contact with. The altar on Mount Ebal, the fallen walls of Jericho, Rahab's house there on the wall, the Balaam inscription, the Hebrew text from Jeremiah's time, and then Jeremiah's altar it down and the House of David inscription is a pretty good pile of evidence for people who say there's no evidence to support the Bible. But where we want to focus and concentrate the rest of our time this evening is on what's called the City of David. Now, a lot of people will think the City of David is Bethlehem, and sometimes that's referred to that way, but usually it refers to the city that David found when he conquered it from the Jebusites. That was the last territory that was conquered by Israel. 2 Samuel 5, the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and they said to David, "You shall not come in here." The Jebusites were just laughing at him and making fun of him. "David can't enter here." Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, the city of David. That was what Jerusalem was at the time he arrived. Again from verse 9, "So David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him." Okay, David was a great king, and he became greater and greater, and he had all of these monuments and buildings, and where's the evidence of that? And there's not a lot of evidence, but there's a whole lot more than they would acknowledge. Why don't we find a lot of evidence of this greater and greater kingdom? Well, you ever hear of the Babylonians? They came in and destroyed this, didn't they? And then they rebuilt, and then here come the Romans, and they destroyed that. And so if you were to find it intact, that would be a catch-22. You don't find it, it's bad. You do find it, it contradicts what we know about the destructions. But we should find some evidence, shouldn't we? And I believe we do. King Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees. Carpenters, stonemasons, they built a house for David. Well, maybe we could find something of that, but then what happens to cedar when you've got people coming in and burning the city? The cedar burns, doesn't it? But then there were foundations. Maybe we could find something. Let's go back and look at some of the history of the archaeological investigation of the city of David. And here's Kathleen Kenyon, one of the key characters again. She, quote, modernized archaeology in Israel, and, of course, was in Jericho from 52 to 58. When she left Jericho, having proved, she thought, that this was not Joshua's Jericho, she went and excavated the city of David from 61 to 68, where she did pass away. I'll refrain from any negative comments about that. Here's what she said. Her assessment from her excavation of the city of David. It may seem disappointing that the excavations have discovered none of the buildings of David's city. Virtually no area remains in which there is any hope of finds of the period. She dug in a relatively small part of the city, but she knows from that there's no hope of finding it anywhere else. The whole of this area must therefore be written off as far as any knowledge of the early Jerusalem is concerned. Well, that's her finding of negative evidence again, which is not good science. Fortunately, it didn't end with her. When she left, she was succeeded by Yigal Shiloh, who was a much more objective and very courageous man, who thoroughly refuted her findings. I wish we had more time to go into detail about that. He excavated from 78 to 85, the date of his untimely death from cancer, before he was able to publish his results. However, Jane Cahill, a modern archaeologist, has been given the task of publishing his results, and it's about half published at this point in process. But she's had a great deal of opposition to publishing that because it's negative to what Kathleen Kenyon found. Succeeding Yigal Shiloh was Ronnie Raich and Ellie Sukron, who are co-directors of the dig that is ongoing today in the city of David. Ellie is actually the major director at this point. And these are very brave men who are exposing the truth under fierce opposition. To give you an illustration of the kind of opposition that's involved, Israel Finkelstein is the director of the Institute of Archaeology at Tel Aviv University. And looking at the way he's standing there, you can get a clue for where he's coming from. He's not a believer. Very much opposed to substantiating the Bible. And he makes this statement, 2003, in Jerusalem Bible and Archaeology, almost no signs of monumental building operations. The mythical united monarchy is a literary construct. It's something they just made up. Literary story to make Israel feel better. But there are no signs of it in archaeology. And then his cohort there at Tel Aviv University's David Yashishkin, who says, "I'm afraid the evidence regarding the magnificent Solomonic capital was not discovered because it is non-existent, not because it's still hidden in the ground." And he knows that because he knows that. That's, again, the negative evidence. Well, what if you find it next year? Well, that means you haven't proved it at all, doesn't it? There's a great deal of evidence that has been found, and Jane Cahill is one of the heroes that is responding to their false information and demonstrating the evidence that does exist. In the same publication, she responded, "The most frequently voiced argument by those who challenge the historical existence of the United Monarchy is a supposed lack of archaeological evidence." And in this context, she's pointing out that the lack of evidence does not prove the absence. You may find it next week. She continues, "In most cases, the arguments are either grossly misleading, illogical, disingenuous, or all three." And I vote for the all three. This is a nice way of saying they're not telling the truth. In Texas, sometimes we say they're lying through their teeth. She's just doing it a little nicer. Or, as one fellow told me from Arkansas, they're lying through their tooth. But what is the evidence? There's opposition. Yes, we acknowledge that. But what are the facts for the city of David? This is the area that is under investigation. It's highlighted here, almost a banana-shaped area. This represented the city of Jerusalem when David arrived, when the Jebusites were there. And this, of course, is the way it looks today. Cahill has restored this in this manner, showing this is approximately the way it looked when David arrived. A major fortification, very difficult to conquer because of the walls and the elevation. How did they do this? Well, you may remember the story that Joab was the hero. He went up through the water shaft and opened the doors from the inside. 2 Samuel 5, David went on that day, "Whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites," these people who had made fun of David, said he's going to be the chief and the captain. And what we see there was the waterworks inside that came from the Gihon spring, watering, and she has in this restoration the pool down at the bottom that we didn't know about till recently. But through the walls, water came out to water the fields, still protected by the walls, but now the water has access to the vessels through the walls. Well, there's a hole there in the wall. And this is where Joab went. And today you can do the same thing. If you go there as a tourist, they put concrete in the bottom, and here my beloved is walking right along on the concrete, a little nicer than Joab had it. But you can walk right up just like Joab did. And verify that this is a real story. The Gihon Springs that supplied the water from inside Jerusalem is described in a number of places in Scripture. 2 Chronicles 32, it was Hezekiah who stopped the upper outlet of the waters of Gihon and directed it to the west side. When Sennacherib was coming, he'd taken the 10 northern tribes. Now then he was coming to take Jerusalem. What are we going to do? Well, we don't want them coming up the water shaft. So we sealed those off and then redirected the water to the west side. This is the spring, as it appears today, still a very prolific spring. This is the front side of it. The back side looks like this, and we can see where the water had been higher, but this artificial notch in the back is what Hezekiah cut and redirected the water from this spring to the west side of the city. And here we can see the Gihon Spring here in red, and that long blue line is the tunnel that was made to redirect the water to the other side. And you can not walk on the concrete here. You have to wade in the water, but you can wade right down that path going right down to the end. Surrounding the spring was the Tower of Siloam that guarded this source of water in Jerusalem. Here it's depicted as four towers, which we initially thought was the case. It really is more one big connected tower with four pinnacles. But this surrounded the spring and protected it. This is the tower that was referred to in Luke 13, you recall, where Jesus says that Tower of Siloam fell and killed 18, and is making an argument there based on that event. The Tower of Siloam fell. Well, do we have any evidence of that? Well, here's the spring, so we excavate around the spring, and sure enough, here's that tower that surrounds it, just as was indicated by the text. And here's our general that we work with pointing to these huge stones. He thinks they may have gone back to the time of the Jebusites. They're huge, large stones that obviously fell and tumbled, killed 18. And as we excavated them and uncovered them, we found a 19th. Actually, that's my son who's clowning around here. He found vertebrae of a donkey next to the fallen tower and decided the donkey kicked the tower over. I don't think so, but it's an interesting hypothesis. Going back to the tunnel that Hezekiah built, stopped the waters of Gihon and directed it to the west side of the city. They went down from the pool, that is, from the Gihon Springs, to a pool, the Pool of Siloam, at the end. That's described several places in the Old Testament. And we see it depicted here in the chart, going down to this little pool down at the end. But looking at the tunnel, as you get almost to the bottom, at the end of that tunnel, you find this interesting depression in the walls of that tunnel. Somebody has cut something out of here. This was an inscription that was made by Hezekiah's people describing the building of the tunnel, and it's now gone, but we know where it is. It's, of all places, in Istanbul, in the archaeological museum there. They removed it, actually, in about 1930. And they have a number of very interesting artifacts from Israel there in that museum. This is a reproduction of that inscription, and the interpretation describes they started on either end and met in the middle, and how the excavate. And it was an amazing engineering feat to accomplish that, all the way down to the Pool of Siloam at the end. Except when you get to that little pool down here, this is not much of a pool. And for years, the tour guides had said, all right, here's the Pool of Siloam, and it's because that's where the tunnel ended, and that's what the text says. It goes down to the Pool of Siloam. And, well, there it is. But this is the pool that was used for purifying the Jews as they went to the temple. They had to bathe, they had to purify themselves before they went to the temple. Thousands of Jews in this little bitty pool. Well, Eli Sukron was certain this was not the real pool, and he thought he had found out where it was. But before we get to that part of the story, let's go back up to the top and look at the stairs that likewise come down from the top. The city of David at the top has the temple, of course, the Temple Mount, which has been destroyed. And the stairs start down and come down to the Pool of Siloam, which is at the bottom. It's a fairly steep grade. And there were stairs that went from the top to the bottom. We read about Nehemiah 3, where he was rebuilding these stairs that go down from the city of David, from the Temple Mount down to the pool. And as we look at the Temple Mount today and the retaining wall that remains, you can see the stairs that begin to go down, and then we see some places where they're eroded, and then others that we haven't been able to excavate, but we've been able to drill down and reach with augers. But these are the stairs that led up to the temple that we read about, and this is where the disciples and Jesus often taught. Here we see what likely was the Gate Beautiful. We read about in Acts chapter 3, where the lame man was there at the gate that goes into the temple, there at the retaining wall. Ugly building has been built right up against it, closing it off. We know this was done by Queen Helena, Constantine's mother, 325 years after Christ. She made all kinds of messes, but that's another story. But you can walk on those stairs, and as you turn to the right, you see the Temple Mount on your left. Directly across is the Mount of Olives, a Sabbath day's journey from the temple, you recall. And then you turn to the right again, back down the steps toward the Pool of Siloam, down toward the end of the city of David. As we go back to the Pool of Siloam, and of course we can't trace it all the way down, but almost, we read from John 9 about the Pool of Siloam. Jesus was there, and that's where he healed the lame man, and says, go wash in the Pool of Siloam. And there's more there than perhaps meets the eye. Here's a blind man, no pun intended there, who had never been to the temple in his life. How do we know that? Because no blind, no lame could enter the temple. But now then he goes to the Pool of Siloam, where they went to purify so they could go to the temple, and he goes to that pool and washes, and now he can see. And so here's the significance. He's now washed, he's purified, and for the first time in his life he can go to the temple. But where is this pool that was purifying so many people? Well, Eli thought it was this green spot down at the bottom. This is a grove of pomegranate trees and figs that are really good. But they're owned by the Anglican Church, and they don't like you excavating there, and they would not give a permit. But you can see that there's a road going across, and that road covered up a sewer pipe that broke. And so they had to repair the sewer pipe. Eli said, can I help? And so they helped repair the sewer pipe and found the stairs going down toward the center part of that pool, about a 2-acre pool surrounded by stairs on all sides. And we've been working on that now since, for a number of years. And still haven't been able to get a permit, but we're repairing the daylights out of that sewer pipe. Lots of mileage. This is the way the Pool of Siloam looked according to Eli's reconstruction. We've excavated about a third of that. And, of course, back to the left is the Temple Mount and this huge escarpment there that guards it. But we were able to be a part of that excavation, and it was exciting. Here's my beloved with Ronnie Raich, who are screening some of the material as we were excavating it. But that temple, that is, that tunnel, ends at this little bitty pool of Siloam. But now here's the big pool. How do we explain the fact that it ends at the little one? Well, it didn't end there. It had been stopped up, and it looked like it ended there, but as we continued to unstop it, finally we uncovered that there was a channel underground that led from that little one to the big one. And here's my son and then Dr. Dye, who's just exited from that tunnel that they opened for the first time, allowing the water to flow from the Gihon Springs all the way down to the big pool of Siloam, probably the first time in 2,000 years. In 2007, another very interesting discovery was made. We're looking now for 4 years for the stairs that went from the Temple Mount down to the Pool of Siloam. Where are those stairs? These are stairs that surrounded the pool, but wow, they end at this big escarpment, a cliff. Toward the west, we can see some stairs, but that's going in the wrong direction. Where in the world was this? We read about it in Nehemiah chapter 3. Here's the Pool of Siloam, the steps going down from the city of David to the Pool of Siloam. This is our general who works with us, Moshe Bronstein. Interesting story there that we don't have time to tell. I arrived, they had made the discovery about a week before I got there. He said, "Don, come here, I want to show you." And right over here where you see the stairs, one of the workmen was, of course, looking for the stairs as we had been. They're wooden stairs, what I said, that we can see in the picture. Where are the stairs that go up to the Temple Mount? He saw this very symmetrical looking wall as a part of this escarpment. It didn't look right to him. And so he whammed it with his sledgehammer, and when he did, it collapsed, and it opened up, and there go the stairs that had been stopped up, covered over with the destruction of Jerusalem, right on up to the Temple Mount. Found because he read the Bible, and it said there were stairs that went from the Pool of Siloam, and they ought to be able to find them, and there they are. Another interesting part of the story is the fact we see some of these stairs broken. We know how and why because of Josephus. He says news had reached many who had earlier escaped from the sieges of Jerusalem who had collected there, talking about the tunnel underneath these stairs. They're trying to escape, and they carried food with them as they did. Arriving at that spot, finding information correct, the Roman commander realized they were there, ordered the infantry to cut down, break into the street among where they were hiding, and 3,000 of them were killed. He poured boiling oil down through those stairs onto the 3,000 that were hiding down in the tunnels, the sewage, very complex sewage system that is directly under the stairs leading down to the Pool of Siloam. Here you see the stairs above and the tunnel beneath. Eli Sukron describes it this way. Many Jews tried to escape Jerusalem where the Romans pursued them. They broke the flagstones descending into the canals of the drainage system, hiding there for days at a time, as was described by Josephus Flavius. You know what we discovered there inside the tunnels? We found cooking vessels, pots, remnants of food inside stone. We also found the skeletons, which we had initially been told to hide lest it stop the dig, but then we found out what it was and who was there. This is one of the pots that was found with the skeletons and the charred Jews that had been killed trying to escape the siege of Jerusalem, one of the cooking pots they were carrying with them as they tried to escape. Our assumption is the vessels were used by the Jews who were hiding there as they were caught by the Roman soldiers. Again and again, you see verification after verification, just evidence on top of evidence. Going back in time archaeologically to the time of Kathleen Kenyon, she was investigating here because there was an obvious structure here. Now, in front of that era, you see what's now known to be the Palace of David, which she didn't know about, and of course is not there, but the foundation, as we'll see in a moment. And what is this huge foundation? It's a foundation of something big, huge. And, of course, it was the foundation for maybe a six-story palace. But it's interesting also because on the foot of it, we have another structure built on top of the foundation, a much later structure, and this complicates our study. Sometimes in one place you can find several different time periods. This dates to the end of the First Temple period, right when the Babylonians came marching in. It's called the Archive Building because it was obvious that a number of important documents were kept there because we find the bully. These were the results of stamping of the clay that was used to seal documents. And then as it was burned, the clay was fired and preserved them. The documents burned up, but we find lots of the bully, as they're called, that would seal the important documents. You see the seal illustrated here, and then the bully on the right that are results of the stamp that have been fired. Well, there's lots of evidence here because somebody was writing these important documents. Who could this be? 51 of them were found. One of them mentions Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, that we read about in 1 Chronicles 9. Of course, this is all a fairy tale. But here's his bully that was found. He was a member of the family of the high priest who officiated at the end of the First Temple period, which is when these documents were burned. And then we read of Jeremiah, the son of Shaphan. There's his bully that was found in this archive building. He was a high official of court of Jehoiakim, the last king, before the Babylonians came in, who reigned into the First Temple period. In the same verse, we read of Baruch. And if you're familiar with Jeremiah, you know Baruch was the scribe who wrote for Jeremiah. He's mentioned some 26 times. We found two of Baruch's bully, a scribe of Jeremiah, and interestingly, one of them seems to preserve his fingerprint. A very interesting description is given in the Archaeology of the Old Testament, published in 98. It's a rather liberal publication, but nevertheless says, this lump of clay used to close the papyrus document was sealed by none other than Baruch, son of Neriah. And refers to Jeremiah 36. Jeremiah, the king's son, who was involved in putting Jeremiah in the pit, he's an important person. Well, yes, here's a document from him that had his seal on it. All in all, there are 51 bulli that have been found. 26 of the 51 attest to biblical characters. Sound like a fairy tale to you? I mean, how do you get more obvious documentation? This is real. These things really happened, and here's the proof of it. Actually, two more were found recently of the two fellows that put Jeremiah in the pit within 50 yards of this. We don't have time to look at that. Let's move quickly to another very important discovery. Reported in, of all places, the New York Times, King David's Palace is found. Well, now, this is this mythical character that didn't exist, and there's no evidence anywhere. And they find his palace. Israeli archaeologist says he's uncovered in East Jerusalem, what may be the fabled palace of King David. This is the one that we read about in 2 Chronicles 5, where King of Tyre built a house for David. Well, who's the King of Tyre? Well, this King of Phoenicia, right? Well, we see in the upper right-hand corner of this dig, where Alot Mazar, the one who made the discovery, is digging, a Phoenician pillar. And what's a Phoenician pillar doing in the middle of Jerusalem? Well, the King of Tyre is the one that built David's palace. He would build a Phoenician design on his pillar. Guess who found that pillar? It wasn't Alot Mazar who made this discovery. It was Kathleen Kenyon, and she covered it up and hid it. And it was then rediscovered by Alot Mazar. She hid the evidence of David's palace. It's located just below the palace, the Temple Mount, and it was a huge structure. We see part of it uncovered that was actually part of the visitor center entering the city of David. And we had a part in that excavation. And several others of the people from Dallas went with us there to help with that. And notice the depth. You go down from where I'm standing, down the ladder, and then down another ladder, and then down. There's six levels that you can see here, going down ladders to the lower part, which is... Anybody know where that is? Sound that was time out a minute because I wanted to show some things there. I may not be able to do that. Anyway, there were several there in that picture that we're digging that I wanted to show, but one of them was one of the elders from the church in Dallas with the cowboy hat. That wasn't a Palestinian. We found pottery, especially at the lowest level. That's all right. That's okay. I think we're fine from here on. I didn't control our level well enough. Pottery from the 10th century B.C., which is exactly the time of David, is found especially there at the lowest level. And royal pottery vessels that indicate something very different from what you normally find, which would be appropriate for the palace. We found a number of other vessels there as well. Notice the description of Alat Nazar. She describes how she did this. Archaeology is technical. You dig with the mind, open to historical sources, and anything can help. I work with the Bible in one hand and the tools of excavation in the other, and try to consider everything. One of the main clues for finding King David's palace, says Mazar, was surprisingly from the Bible itself. 2 Samuel 5:17 states that David heard about it and went down from his palace to the citadel. Well, we knew where the citadel was. From it, you go down from his palace to the citadel, so you go up to his palace, and from that, together with the pillar that Kathleen Kenyon had found, she said, this is where it ought to be, and published. This is where it ought to be. I'm going to dig and see. And she dug, and that's where it was, which is the way you do science. Summarizing then, we looked in the first part at just a general view of some of the things I've had association with across Israel. And then from the city of David, where there's supposed to be no evidence at all, we've got Joab's water shaft and the Gihon Springs and the Tower of Siloam that fell. You've got Hezekiah's tunnel, the pool of Siloam, now this huge place that was found, the stairs from the temple to the pool, this huge foundation, which was the foundation of David's palace, the administration or archive building with the 51 bullet, 26 attest to biblical characters, and then the palace of David itself, six stories high. But there's no evidence for the city of David. We understand then Cahill's statement when she says this is the argument is a supposed lack. Well, the lack doesn't prove, but it's a supposed lack, and the arguments are either grossly misleading, illogical, disingenuous, or all three. Well, she's justified in that statement when you see the kind of evidence that is available. We'll conclude with a statement by Adam Zertal, who was formerly chairman of the Department of Archaeology. He was demoted as a result of his conversion to Christianity. But he's still there as an active archaeologist. He was wounded in the Yom Kippur War, and as a war veteran and a wounded veteran, he has enough clout that they can't get rid of him. He says, after years of research, however, and his area was Manasseh, he was investigating that for about 20 years. He says it's impossible to explore Israel's origins without the Bible. After years of research, however, I believe it's impossible. Again and again, we have found and seen the historical value of the Bible. Again and again, we've seen an accurate memory has been preserved in the transmuted narratives, exposed by archaeological fieldwork and critical mine work. Not reading Genesis, but actual fieldwork in archaeology. Again, this his brown area was his area. The area is relevant in particular for the reliability of the early Bible. Nearly 1,000 new sites explored. This is over 20 years. He's found 1,000 sites in the area of Manasseh that correlate with Scripture. 1,000 data points. Well, you need some more evidence. That gets a little old after a while. Explored create a new archaeological reality, which connects the books of Deuteronomy, Joshua, and Judges to the territory where they have happened. I think we're justified in saying that the evidence from the stones of Israel is absolutely overwhelming, both throughout Israel, which we've just touched the hem of the garment of, but especially in the city of David, where they say there's no evidence at all. And we can do exactly what we're commanded to do, 1 Peter chapter 3, be ready to give a defense to anyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. There is abundant evidence and a reasonable defense, so much so that it becomes very unreasonable to deny it. And some of them are going to do that for political motivations, for personal reasons, but it's not because of the evidence, it's in spite of it. If you're here this evening and haven't rendered obedience to the gospel, you are without excuse. There's no reason to doubt what the Bible tells us. You're going to face it in the day of judgment. Come confessing your faith and repenting of your sins, being baptized into Christ. If you've wandered away, come back while we stand together and sing.